Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, you put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor, because you know the bigger the fight, the better the reward. Medela, the mark of the fight. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
The Steve Austin Show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline.ag. It's the middle of October, and even though it might be cool outside, the sports betting action right now is red hot. We've got the NFL, NHL, MMA, and the baseball playoffs all happening at once. Get in the mix at BetOnline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Hey, welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Every week, we are bringing out some of the most requested episodes of the podcast from behind the archives. We have another great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
All right, let's get into it. It is producer Sean with another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show, episode number 92, with Dutch Mantell, a.k.a. Zeb Coulter, a.k.a. Uncle Zebekiah. Original air date, February 19th, 2014. Around this time, Zeb Coulter was the manager of the Real Americans, featuring Jack Swagger and Antonio Cesaro. This was Cesaro before he lost his first name. But many of you may just know Dutch Mantell as Zeb Coulter, but he has done so much more in the wrestling business. He has been around forever, and he has contributed to a lot of things that you may or may not have been aware of. Of course, Dutch Mantell, as I mentioned, was also known as Uncle Zebekiah, the manager of the Blue Brothers, a.k.a. the Harris Brothers, a.k.a. the Disciples of Apocalypse, Skull and 8-Ball. And he also briefly managed Justin Hawk Bradshaw, who would now become John Bradshaw Layfield. But yeah, Dutch Mantell has been around forever. He has done so much in the pro wrestling business. He is a big mainstay in the Mid-South, Memphis area, worked a lot in Continental, also worked in Puerto Rico for many years and was a head booker there for a long time. He was around there when Bruiser Brody was murdered. If you watched Viceland's The Dark Side of the Ring, he is a big part of that discussion. And they do talk about that on this podcast, as well as a lot about working in Puerto Rico and just a lot of Dutch's philosophies on working as a heel and just wrestling philosophies in general. He's, you know, how he got into the wrestling business. And a lot of you probably may know, but it bears repeating, that Dutch Mantell gave Steve Austin the Steve Austin moniker because he met Steve Austin at the very beginning of his career. And they talk about the first impressions and their first meeting and the details of that in this episode. Also, I just wanted to bring this up. Dutch Mantell was a part of the Dirty Dutch Mantell. Let's get that straight. Dirty Dutch Mantell was a part of the group known as the Desperados in WCW in 1991. For those of you folks that were watching WCW programming on TBS at that time, just like your boy here, he was a part of this group known as the Desperados. It was him, Black Bart, and Deadeye Dick, also known as Moondog Spot. They were a trio doing vignettes where they were looking for Stan Hansen to lead them to glory. Stan Hansen never showed up, from what I understand, but it was very much a blink and you'll miss it type of program going on for those guys in WCW in the early 90s. But yeah, great conversation here. Steve also talks of, there's also a cool story, and you have to catch it, where he talks about, Steve Austin talks about slamming the Godfather, I'm just calling him the Godfather, Charles Wright, as we all know him as, there's a good story in there about that. So lots of stuff packed into this episode. I think you're going to dig it. This day in Steve Austin history, let's get into it. Today being October 24th, we start off in 1993 for WCW in New Orleans, Louisiana. It is Halloween Havoc 1993, which saw WCW U.S. champion Dustin Rhodes defeat stunning Steve Austin. And after the bout, Steve Austin busted open Dustin's head with the title belt because he thought he won, but he didn't. 1996, we go to the WWF in Springfield, Illinois. Steve Austin defeated the Stalker, Barry Windham. Then in 1997 in Long Island, New York, Dude Love with Steve Austin in his corner defeated Davey Boy Smith with Jim the Anvil Neidhart in his corner in a Long Island street fight. This was originally to be a tag team match with Dude Love and Steve Austin versus Davey Boy and Owen Hart, but Steve was still recouping from his injuries from the SummerSlam 1997 pile driver he received from Owen Hart, so it had to be a street fight between Dude Love and Davey Boy. 1998 in Greensboro, North Carolina, Steve Austin defeated Kane, Mankind, and The Undertaker in a fatal four-way in a steel cage match. This is a little bit of a different result than the matches they've been having as of recent. 1999 in St. Louis, Missouri, Steve Austin defeated WWF World Champion Triple H via disqualification. Then we go to 2000 in Long Island, New York. We're back in Long Island for an episode of WWF SmackDown, which saw Rikishi defeat Too Cool in a handicap match. After the match, Rikishi called out Steve Austin. This, of course, is after the time where it was revealed that Rikishi did it for The Rock and ran over Steve Austin at Survivor Series 1999 in a car. And he calls out Stone Cold. Steve Austin comes out, but he was attacked backstage by an unknown assailant. It's kind of confusing the way this is written, but it sounds like Rikishi battled Austin in the entranceway and hit him with the rump shaker in the ring. I don't know who was the unknown assailant that attacked Steve Austin. Probably was Triple H, because I think it was eventually revealed that it was Triple H behind everything. My memory serves me, that's how that played out. Finally, we go to 2005 in Fresno, California for an episode of WWF Raw. We have an in-ring promo from Jonathan Coachman where he calls out Steve Austin just prior to their scheduled match at Taboo Tuesday. Steve Austin's music begins to play, and his pickup truck rides to the ring, and Stephanie McMahon is driving the truck. Just to say that Steve Austin wasn't in the building, well then how the hell did she get a hold of his truck if he wasn't there? That is today in Steve Austin history. Today being October 24th, I get my information from the history of WWE.com. All right, folks, thanks for listening. We'll come right back with Dirty Dutch Mantel on a classic episode of The Steve Austin Show.
This year in college football has been lights out, and every Saturday, 317 Gimmick Street is buzzing with gridiron greatness. For all you college football fans, do yourself a favor and get in on the sports betting action because it is off the charts. Here's what we got this weekend. Auburn taking on LSU, Notre Dame squaring off against Michigan, Penn State versus Michigan State, and a massive game that pits Wisconsin against Ohio State. That will be a barn burner. Visit our good friends and exclusive partners of Podcast One, betonline.ag, to take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code Podcast1. Again, that's betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partners of Podcast One Sportsnet.
And now, a word from Martellus Bennett, a professor at the Dos Equis College Football College.
Hey, college football fans, Martellus Bennett here. Do you want to win every football argument this season? Dominate every debate? Become a pigskin prodigy? Then enroll in a Dos Equis College Football College, where you'll learn from football insiders like me, Jay Cutler, Katie Nolan, and author John Bacon, the man who wrote the book on college football. So be the first in your family to earn a football watching certificate from a beer school. Enroll in Dos Equis College Football College at dosequis.com/edu.
Enjoy Dos Equis responsibly. Imported by Cervezas Mexicanas, White Plains, New York. Copyright 2019 Dos Equis Beer Brands. Official beer sponsor of the college football playoff.
Finally, there's a football beer school for me. Thanks, Martellus.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Sitting in the room with Dutch Mantel, you guys out there.
It's my story.
Oh, it's his story. Okay. We're sitting here in the room with Dutch Mantel here at the, where are we at, the Sheraton?
at the Sheraton downtown L.A.
This beats the hell out of back in a day in the USWA territory. Those flea boxes we used to stay in.
Well, I'm glad to make you show. I've heard so much about it, and people tell me, said, have you talked to Steve? Or he talks about you all the time, and I'm glad to be on your show, really. Now, who would have thought... When were we driving up down the road?
Man, that was
20 years ago.
1990.
Yeah. And who would have thought that we would end up in downtown LA doing a podcast like this?
I mean, if you'd have told me.
Life is funny.
Yeah. If you'd have told me back in the day that you and I, well, first of all, that I even have podcasts because I ain't into the technology scene. Yeah. But obviously, many years later, and here we are in Los Angeles, California, after our illustrious times down there in the USWA territory based out of Nashville, Tennessee, riding up down the road in my 1988 Hyundai Excel. And many times we had Chris Champion crammed in the back seat.
He was there. You remember the snowstorm?
Yeah, the snowstorm. We were going, now just see, everybody, when you talk about the USWA, it's based out of Nashville, Tennessee.
Based out of Nashville.
And here was
but
here.
You tell people today how the wrestling business used to be,
right?
And they said, "Really? It was that way? It was only the hard, you know, the hardcore know it. And the internet, I guess, the wrestling community knows about it,
right?
But most of these kids now, they don't know that they actually were other companies that existed before WWE, but they were, and that's where all these guys, where you came from, that's where I came from, and all the masters came through that system,
the little territories.
Yeah.
And back in the day, I mean, man, you could have guys on the card. You know, I showed up. I had been in the business 2 months, literally, and they were just beating the tar out of me at the Dallas Sportatorium Friday nights and Saturday mornings for the television taping. You know, heels get a little heat on me. I was a young upcoming baby face. You know, wasn't worth a nothing. I was green, as you would soon find out when I rolled in to the Mid-South Coliseum. But that was a great territory to learn in because I've told this, the schedule before, but let's go through it. Monday was
Memphis,
Tennessee. Tuesday was Louisville, Kentucky. Wednesday was Evansville, Indiana. Thursday was a spot show, usually somewhere within about 100 miles of Nashville.
Yeah.
Most of the boys lived in Nashville. Of course, the King, Jerry Lawler, always lived in Memphis.
Yes.
And then after the spot show, we'd jump on that bus, drive all night to Dallas, Texas to work the Sportatorium Friday night.
So.
You didn't do that one?
No, I took off.
Okay, you took off on that show.
When they started doing that, I said, I don't do this.
Oh, so anyway, so we'd go to the liquor store, get some beer, come back, drive all night, make Memphis TV on Saturday morning, go back to the parking lot where we parked our cars, and the tour bus, go home, take a shower, end up at the fairgrounds on Saturday night.
In Nashville.
Right. And then Sunday might have been a spot show or you would be off. And that was a great territory to learn. Because, man,
but
you got to get your chops up. Uh-oh.
No, it was...
The territory seemingly was always down on my end. I don't know what you guys were making. I was making $15 to $20 a night, and when I look back at some of my performances, they probably overpaid me by two times what I was actually worth. But let's talk about the first time when I rolled into the Mid-South Coliseum. I talked to Jerry.
What year was this?
This was in 1990. I broke in the back end of 1989.
Yep.
And they'd been beating the tar out of me in the Sportatorium for a couple of months. I was working still full-time at Watkins Motor Lines, loading and unloading trucks. And I said, Jerry, well, I mean, hey, man, that's what I did.
Yeah.
And but Jerry had just kind of bought that.
You said, I got to be a star.
Got to be a star.
Got to
be a superstar, baby.
I can't be loading these trucks all day long.
Well,
this is what I was in Memphis, and I was like what they call the booker.
You was booking.
You was right. There's no such thing as a booker now. You don't have bookers. You have, I guess, creative.
Right.
You don't have bookers. But I liked the booker days because you had one guy. You say, hey, do it this way, or this is what I got.
Right.
And that day, Memphis, I'm running down there, and I'm trying to get everybody lined up. Lance Russell was running around. He's the announcer, and Lawler was whatever he was.
And I was the first guy in the building that day. I showed up in my car, and there I was just kind of milling around the dressing room. Here comes Ricky Morton. Hey, man, my name's Steve Williams. Yeah. Ricky Morton. He looked at me up and down. You know how Ricky Morton does. Can you work? That's first thing out of anybody's mouth back in the day. Can you work?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I guess that's what I'm here to do. Continue.
Well, I'm standing in the dressing room. I didn't even know you were coming.
I know.
Nobody told me. Jerry Jarrett talked to you, but guess what? He didn't talk to me. And so Bill Dundee came up to me and he says, hey, you got this new kid showing up. I said, who? He said, I don't know. Some kid from Dallas. I says, no, nobody's coming in. He said, oh, yeah, there is. I said, nobody told me. He said, well, I'm just telling you, he's going to show up. So in you walk with the blonde hair. And I look at you, and you introduce yourself. My name's Steve Williams. I says, okay, good to meet you, blah, blah, blah. And then we get to talking, and I says, all right, you can't be Steve Williams here. And you said, why I don't not? Know. I don't know why in the F not. That's my name.
Did I say that?
Yes, you did. That's what you said.
See, because in your book.
We just met.
Okay, what was the first book you wrote?
World According to Dutch.
The World According to Dutch. I read that book from cover to cover. You sent it to me. It's a great book. And you said in that book that I was a little bit on the cocky side. I didn't think I was that cocky, was I? Okay, so anyway, continue.
No, you were just being you.
Okay, I was just being you, me, but I was cocky.
I liked it from the beginning. And you said, well, I don't know why now. If not, that's my name. I said, listen, they already got a Steve Williams. You said, who? I said, Dr. Death Steve Williams. I said, you can't have two Steve Williams. It's like having two Willie Nelsons. You can't have it.
You put Steve Williams on a card and they're expecting Dr. Death, and they see my chump ass with long, stringy blonde hair who's greener than grass. It ain't cool.
And I remember saying, okay, listen, think of a name. I'll be back in a minute. I went and did something else.
Yeah.
And I came
back. And now you said 15 minutes. That's exactly what you said. And here I am, a young cat in the business, got to make a life, decision here that's going to affect the rest of my career. So I didn't come up with squat.
So then I came back. I said, hey, have you thought of a name? No. I said, all right, keep thinking. I got to do something else. So I left again.
Yep.
I came back, and there's Lance Russell standing there. He said, okay, you were on first. He said, what's his name? I said, well, let me find out. You got a name? You said, no. I said, well, what the? I said, okay, listen. And for, I don't know, it just popped here. I said, listen, tonight you're Steve effing Austin. And you says, like the $6 million man? I said, no, and I'm being a smart ass.
I know, and I said, I don't want to be Steve Austin. So you gave me a couple more minutes to think of a name. Then you come back for the next round. You said, what'd you come up with? And I said, I ain't come up with nothing. And you said, that's your name. You're going to be Steve Austin.
Yeah.
And I was backed into a corner. I went out as Steve Austin that night.
You went out in the first match.
Yeah.
So I go out and watch the match, and you come back.
No, remember this? That was Mid-South Coliseum. And so Frankie the Thumper Lancaster was going to do a little smiles with somebody. And I was just supposed to go in there and stooge the referee. And then I was going to get in the ring and do some physicality with one of the guys. And the guy says, you're going to end up, you told me you're going to end up pinning, goddamn, who's that blind guy that used to work back in the day? Was it Mike Davis?
Yep.
It was Mike Davis. Mike Davis was going to do something with me. Boom, 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 boom. I was going to end up pinning him 1, 2, 3. And I looked at you when you told me this.
Yeah.
And because I was going over in a makeup match after Frankie the Thumper worked with him. And I looked at you with a total deadpan because I thought I was going to get beat. And I said, I'm going to lose. And you said, no, you're not going to lose. You're going to get a quick count on Mike Davis. And that was my first night out in Mid-South Coliseum.
I thought you had a match, no?
No.
Okay.
No, but I want to go to the match where...
Was that the way I said it in the book? I can't remember the match. You can't remember the book.
Yeah. Well, I
mean... making this up.
I've been hitting the head with too many steel chairs, and you've been around a long time.
But anyway, the story goes, you come back, and you said, hey, and you're all excited, and said...
No, that was in Lebanon, Tennessee, when I worked with a guy in a hood.
One.
Another one? Okay, go ahead.
That's the night you hooked up with Undertaker.
No. We were in a spot show, and I want to say it was Lebanon, Tennessee. It could have been any town. Okay, but check it out. The Undertaker thing was going to happen in Evansville. I'll tell you the story on that. But anyway, so what happened was we were out on the road, and you said, all right, what do you want me to do? And you said, I was working with that guy who used to work in a hood, and it was Gilbert. A Gilbert guy in a hood. It wasn't Doug Gilbert. It wasn't Eddie Gilbert.
Not Tommy.
Was that him? A guy about 5'10" in a hood?
So.
Anyway, so I was working with a guy in a hood, and I went out there. My headlock was way down low, around the waist level. Everything was very, very bad. Of course, I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
I ended up going over. I got the win, and I come back. But I remember when you told me,
you
said...
You're already a star.
Yeah.
You won two matches. You just got there.
Your instructions were, you said, all right, Dad, go out there and give us about 8 or 10 minutes. All of a sudden, I'm thinking, 8 or 10 minutes? What in the hell am I going to do for 8 or 10 minutes? That's that green part where, all I needed was maybe two.
That's how you learn.
I know. So we went out there, stomped the joint out. And, of course, I thought it was outstanding. And I come into that damn dressing room, and you said, come here. And, boy, you chewed my ass out. Ate and gave me the riot act. Chris, come over here. You told Chris Shaman, come over here. I put Chris, he's going to put Chris in headlock, and I put him in that sorry headlock that I had. He go, put his head up here. That way you can hear him when he's talking to you, and you can continue to critique my match in a very aggressive fashion. Finally, he pointed at a steel chair. He said, you see that chair over there? And I said, yeah. He goes, I didn't know what you were going to tell me to do with it. I thought you'd tell me to stick it up my ass. Yeah. Something smart, Alec. And he said, you grab that chair, and you go out there and sit in that door, and you watch every single match on the card. He goes, that's the only way you're going to learn this stuff.
Right.
And boy, I tell you what, almost for the rest of my career, I watched damn near every single match on the card to see what people, what the guys were doing in the ring, what the crowd was reacting to. And
that's what surprised me. When I told you to grab the chair and watch every match every night for the whole time you're here, and then later on that night, I actually saw you sitting there.
Yeah.
You're chewing tobacco and watching the match. And I went, my God, here's a wrestler who actually does what you tell him to do. But I've often told people, I said, that's why I think Steve Austin was successful, because he became a serious student of what he was trying to do.
Right.
And you made it work for you. It was good.
Hey, what was the deal with you and your promos? Because I always hear people talk about promos, and you're one of the best promos of all time. You have Gift for Gab. What was your thought process behind promos? Because it took me a long time to bring that up to speed. And, you know, when they stuck, I never really had any promo time down there in Dallas. I started feuding with Chris Adams, a little bit of time here and there, but it was just all that, you know, run-of-the-mill stuff that you talk when you think you're a wrestler. Didn't really have any concept yet. So what's your thought process on you just one of those talkative, gifted Gab-type cats or what?
Well, you got to talk to people that they kind of understand what you're talking about. And when I tell wrestlers today, and I would tell any performer, we tell you this, you know, the best thing that you have to do in wrestling is when you walk through that curtain, you got to own the place. But secondly, you've got to connect with those people.
Right.
Some way. And if they like the way you talk, you know, and then of course they like the way you wrestle, you connect that way. But the best way to get them, when you get them here, when you touch their heart and you make them feel something, you got them.
Right.
And that's what I always tried to do. I never tried to talk over their head. I didn't talk at them. I talked to them. I wanted them to feel me. Like we're sitting here talking back and forth.
Right.
And see, my style of talking never changed, whether I'm talking to you right here or whether I'm talking to a camera. I wanted those, and wrestling is so unique in that, like basketball players are, you can see them, they come in on their faces, but wrestling, they come right in on your face. And you, if you tell somebody who's telling a really good story,
right,
like watching a movie, you feel it.
Right.
And when you feel it, you got them.
Right.
I hate that you got me. I'm saying if somebody's telling me something and I'm believing it, I'm connecting with them.
Right.
And so whatever he does from then on out, if he gets hurt, if he gets his feelings hurt, he gets beat up, it's almost like you're kicking me.
Right.
It's almost like if he limps, I'm limping with him.
Right.
And that's what I always tried to do. And now they can give you all kind of, if you say this and say that, well, you can say it, but it's whether the people accept it and whether they feel it. Like when you do interviews,
you have to mean it.
You gotta mean it. And well, you don't have to mean it, but you got to make the people think you mean it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. To me,
that's where the art comes in. And what I've said about wrestling a long time, sometimes the art of actually wrestling is not, it's not eroding, but I think it has diminished somewhat.
And why is that?
I don't know why it is, because I think years ago when they had all the territories, see, when I tell guys, you know, I'm going to tell this story. So I was sitting around the table somewhere in catering the other day or something, and I started talking. And Pat Patterson was there, too, and we started talking. And Pat was telling this, and I'm telling this, and I'm talking about Ernie Ladd, and he's talking about Montreal, and I'm talking about Memphis, and he's talking about San Francisco. And we're telling these stories that are so long ago, it's almost in the lore of wrestling. And all of a sudden, I look up, and there's 10 guys standing around looking. I swear, it's like story time.
Right.
Hey, Uncle Bill, tell me this story. And they were all standing around, and they were like wide-eyed kids.
Right.
They had never heard it before. And unless I wrote two books. One's called The World According to Us. The other's called Tales from a Dirt Road.
And you're supposed to send me that when you ain't sent it yet.
I didn't.
Anyway, go back to
the story. I sent you the first one.
Yeah, you did. I'll buy the second one. Call it even.
Unless some of these stories are written down and documented, they'll just be lost.
Oh, that'd be a shame, too.
It would be. Yeah. There's so many stories that are still untold.
Right.
And, you know, one thing in my books, and I think all books should be this way, I don't out anybody.
No.
If somebody
That's
is
not
like,
what it's about.
If he has a problem with drugs, I don't say that.
Right.
If he has a problem with whatever, drinking, this, I don't bring it out because I wouldn't want it brought out about me.
No.
Not that I have any faults anyway.
Never.
You know, they'd have to tell a lie if they said it about me.
Yeah, of course.
But I don't want that brought out. And it's a funny book. Everything is humorous, and I don't really I don't see the purpose of that. Because a lot of guys, and I'm not saying this to target anyone, but nobody wants to hear, this guy didn't like me, and this is why I got held back, and oh, no. This guy tried to screw me, and this. And nobody wants to hear that. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear it, because to me, that's their private agenda,
right.
And whatever they're trying to push, okay, I'm agreeing with you. Just tell me a good story. Just tell
if someone wants to talk specifically about their personal problems, and they want to put their stuff out there, I'm okay with that. But just, you know, me, like my podcast, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody. If it's not good,
we can't say anything bad about eBay.
I'm leaving right now.
But you remember the snowstorm.
I remember the snowstorm, but man, I've bits and pieces of it. I just know that you and me had left Nashville. From Nashville to Memphis, it's 205 miles one way. All of a sudden, we're driving down there, it gets real hairy, and things start freezing up. You continue.
It was bad weather that day.
Who was I working with that night? You were the booker? I mean, I'm sure it's a great angle to help my cause.
It was going
to
blow the roof off.
Genius.
It was going to blow the roof off the Mid-South. But it was bad weather, and they're predicting snow, but it's going to miss us. No, it's the Weather Channel said, no problem. So we start driving in your Air Honda.
Yep.
So we're driving down, and it starts snowing a little harder. And I had called, I called Lawler. I said, hey, you're not going to cancel it? No, we're not going to cancel. We don't do that.
And that was a call from either your place or off the side of the road, because we didn't have our cell phones back in.
No, we didn't have any cell phones. So we start driving, and the closer we got to Memphis, the more the snow started coming down. And by the time we got to Memphis, hell, we was in a damn blizzard. And so I remember, and it was getting dark too, and it's colder than hell. And we get off at Highland Avenue, and we try to work our way around to that Coliseum. And we pull in, and we run right into Lawler pulling out. And you rolled your window down, and you said, hey, we're running? No, we're not running. It's a blizzard. What is wrong with you guys? Are you crazy?
And the thing about this. Lawler lives in Memphis. He didn't just drive 205 miles. He didn't have 205 miles to drive back home.
So it's 6 o'clock in the afternoon and it's dark. This is January, February. So we start back another 205. It's actually long. It's about 230 is what it is. But okay. It's a long way. Now we got to go through the storm. Now the storm was moving east and we were going west. So we was, on the way back, now it's longer. Now it's going the way we're going.
Yep.
And we go about, 100 miles. I remember your windshield had a little crack in it.
Yeah.
And somehow some moisture would get in. It actually started snowing in your car. We were inside. And we made it as far as some truck stop. And we spent the night on the side at the truck stop sleeping on one of the booths there.
Right.
And we got back in about the next day about 11 o'clock. And I remember I got sick, almost died of the flu or a really bad cold. And I never will forget that. We got in. Finally, we slipped and slid and worked our way back in.
Every time I would say something, just in conversation or whatever, you'd always pull out one of your Dutchisms. Well, you want to be a wrestler. Or I would say something, or you would ask me a question, I'd give you an answer, just a plain vanilla answer. You know, we ain't got to get hot about it.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, this guy really thinks I'm mad. And I didn't say nothing. I use that to this day.
Yeah.
We used to ride down the road.
You actually texted me that yesterday. Well, you don't have to get hot about it.
Yeah. Well, hell, it looked like you were texting a little aggressively back at me. We had so much fun traveling down the road. Well, I did. I mean, you might have been bored.
No, I did. I had a great time. I really did.
But we were riding down the road, and that's what, you know, a lot of guys these days are doing tour buses. And I would like to maybe have gotten into a tour bus maybe towards the back end of my career. Maybe I would have held off another year or two. But we would ride down the road in that Memphis territory and tell stories and talk about the business and talk about the matches, about psychology. I'd ask you why you did this, what for, when, why. It was all about learning the business and just talking about it.
In my book, I talk about how I learned the business, and it was riding with guys who'd been there before.
Right.
I would get in the car, and the three veterans, they'd been there.
Yeah.
Been this 10 years, 15 years, and I'd be the driver.
Right.
And they'd start drinking beer after the matches were over.
Right.
And I'd give them, especially in summer, the windows were down, and, you know, we'd all, you know, sweat. And when you drink that beer, it'd start hitting them.
Yeah.
And then I'd ask one of them, hey, did you see my match? And they said, yeah. And then they start talking to me. Actually, my schooling started at about 11:30 every night.
Right.
And it would last from an hour to an hour and a half.
Right.
Then they start telling stories. And I said, and that's where I learned the history of pro wrestling, is listening to them.
Who were some of the guys that were maybe influential in your psychology or your work style in the ring? Obviously, you were Dutch Mantell in the ring, but who helped inspire that, or how'd you come up with your style?
One of the first guys who ever really became one of my mentors was the Assassin Number One, yep. Tom Renisto, and then Jody Hamilton. Yep. But Tom much more than Jody, because I would ride with Tom.
Right.
And he would talk, and he'd tell me all these stories. Of course, through the years, I can't even remember all the old-timers that told me this story here and this story here. And then I would learn about... See, when I tell guys now, when I started out, we talk about the WWE, the only game in town now.
Right.
And you know, they're massive. It's just unbelievable how big they are. Yeah, but right. Back when I started, they were 34 different companies you could work for.
Yeah.
If you were out of work, it was because you just didn't want to work, or you were just horrible.
Right.
You could only be halfway proficient, yeah. And still you could go and, you know, you could work. You know, when you start naming them, you know. I remember one time when I first realized how far I could go or how much I could travel. I was in, like, Georgia, started in Georgia, and the guy liked me, and he said, "Hey, when you get ready to move, tell me, and I'll get you in L.A. And I went... I didn't know they had wrestling in L.A. I didn't know. I just thought it was like Mid-Atlantic and Georgia's all I knew.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you didn't get that on television, how would you know?
Right. And he says, I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Oh, I'll just call the guy. I even forgot his name. Mike LaBelle or somebody in L.A. He said, "I'll call him, and all I got to do is say you want to come out there and you work out there." I said, "I can go to California?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I can even get you booked across the country, and you can work your way to California." And I went, "You got to be kidding me." See, I didn't know how. I had to learn the business. Right. I didn't know. Nobody actually sat down and said, "This is the way it works." It was on the job training. Let me tell you how silly I was. I first met Abdullah the Butcher, right?
Yeah.
In Atlanta, and I looked at him, and he didn't speak in the dressing room. And I'd look at him. It was 3 weeks before I found out he was really not from the Sudan, because he never talked.
Yeah.
And I actually thought he was from the Sudan. I thought he was a butcher. I didn't know. And then I found out he was from Montreal or Toronto or somewhere, and I went, "Really?"
Yeah.
And I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
But see, that was the beauty of wrestling back in those days, because, you know, guys, he protected his own image even inside the dressing room.
Right. How long did it take you to really pick up the goings-ons of being inside the square circle from a standpoint of, you know, obviously the mechanics are one thing, and you got that down, obviously, I would think, at an early age. Psychology. How long did it take you to put together, you know, premier psychology to work a hellacious program, be it heel, babyface?
Well, I never really, you don't really stop, learning, tell you the truth. You can still I can learn today, but... For me to actually I've kind of got the concept, but it was applying the concept, executing the concept. And I'm talking about when I would come out of the ring, the guys saying, "Hey, come here." Yeah. You know, like I did you.
Yeah.
That's how you learn.
Yeah.
You know, "Come here. Don't do this. And don't do that. And that is stupid." And, you know, it wasn't an overall view every night, but it was like bits and pieces.
Right.
And you got to take those bits and pieces and to make it a whole.
Right.
And it probably took me... I don't know. I started, it probably took me 3 or 4 years.
Right.
But in those 3 or 4 years, I was working territories, and I was working 6 days and sometimes 7 days a week. And I went to Louisiana one time. Don't remind me why I went there. I don't know. But sometimes you'd work twice on Sunday, twice on Saturday.
Double shots.
My God. Yeah. I said, and you'd work like 3 o'clock show, and then get in the car, go.
Yeah.
And you'd run to this next town, and then you'd work there, and then you'd go home. See, sometimes you tell I remember we had to make some trip, not too long ago, and we had bad, we was coming in from Europe, and we had to make some town, and the weather was bad, and somebody said, "Well, we may have to rent a car," and it was about 400 miles.
Right.
I said, "Guys, we got to rent a car. "Well, I'm not renting a car." I'm not going to say who said this. "I'm not renting a car." And I sit back, and I says, "Wait a minute. If they tell you to rent a car... You're going to rent a car, and you're going to drive 400 miles with a big smile on your face."
Right.
Because, hey, we used to do this every day, and you're saying, "No, you can't do it."
Yeah.
But we didn't have to do it. I mean, we got there. But, you know, sometimes we used to do this every day. Mid-South, we drive any day under a 200-mile trip one way. It's almost like a day off.
Right. And that was considered a short trip.
Well, it wasn't a short trip, but that was the shortest one they had.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So it was a short trip.
Yeah, it was.
But okay, but let's go back a little bit. Now,
and we didn't have trainers.
Right, no.
We didn't have doctors. If you got hurt, hey, you better be at that town tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you know why?
But that's what a lot
of... you wouldn't eat.
Hey, man, is it a hassle to take your carcass around town to get all your office supplies and equipment? Damn right it is. Do you have to stand for it? Oh, hell no. Let our guys at Zorro.com make it easy for you because they got everything you need in one place. Zorro.com, spelled Z-O-R-O, is where you'll find everything you need for businesses of any size and almost any industry. Electrical, plumbing, contracting, manufacturing. Don't sweat it because Zorro has you covered. Zorro.com has tools and equipment, safety and office supplies, cleaning gimmicks, and more from brands you know and trust such as Stanley, 3M, Milwaukee, Schneider, and Rubbermaid, just to name a few. Zorro.com offers amazing customer service from real people based in the U.S. And you'll dig the fast, free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Just for listeners of the Steve Austin Show, visit Zorro.com/Austin to sign up for Zmail and get 15% off your first order. Again, that's Zorro.com/Austin for 15% off your first order. Zorro.com/Austin. Get it all in one place. All of us here at the Steve Austin Show are extremely grateful for all the support you've shown us over the years. You guys are absolutely badass. We'd like to ask a small but very important favor of you. It'll only take a few minutes, and if you're one of the first people to do it, Podcast One will make it worth your time. Literally, we need you to complete a short survey because the information you give us can help make things better for the show and you as a listener. Just go to podcastone.com/survey and everything will be right there for you. That's podcastone.com/survey. First 250 people who complete the survey will get a $10 gift card to Amazon.com. And two grand prize winners will be selected at random to get a $100 Amazon gift card. You hear that? That's free money. It's a win-win. Our shows are supported by advertisers, so filling this out will really help us cater to needs of you as a listener. So again, visit podcastone.com/survey, answer some questions, and potentially make some money along the way. Thank you for being a dedicated listener, and that's the bottom line.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
Dirty Dutch Mantel,
mm-hmm,
from Altroff, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the Dirty Dutch come from, and why Altroff, Texas?
Well, I didn't want to be from Dallas, Texas. I didn't want to be from Atlanta, Georgia. I didn't want to be from Miami. I wanted to be out of a place where people, everybody knows where that is. So
right.
I said, well, if I say Altroff, Texas,
yeah,
people say, where in the hell is Altroff, Texas? So people used to ask me, hey, where is Altroff? And I said, you know where El Paso is? They said, yeah. I said, but it's nowhere close to there. So look at another part of the map.
Yeah.
And, you know, Altroff, I just made it up. It was and the dirty part, Dutch, I had to pick a D's of dirty. So
yeah,
I just made it up. Somebody said, who gave you that? I said, nobody gave me that. Yeah. I created it. Unless you created it yourself,
right,
nobody else is going to take the time to create that.
Right.
So and I just went out there and... I would just say, hey, it's going to be a fight, and you're not going to win it. So,
right.
And if I'm going to hit you first, because I know you're going to hit me, so I'm going to try to hit you first. So.
Right.
Well, actually, the dirty part, I went to Puerto Rico, and dirty was sucio, and I became sucio Dutch, even though it was an S.
Right.
It's sucio Dutch Mantel. And it worked there, so I brought it back, and I just took that, translated it back to English. And I always told everybody in Puerto Rico, one reason that I went down there and really... kind of, for the time, we were doing 16,000-seat houses. We'd sell it.
Oh, that's astronomical.
I was the first American to go down there and trash-talk the island. You know, I told him.
How much heat did that get?
Oh, my God. I couldn't walk on the street.
Straight up couldn't walk on the street.
No, I could not walk on the street. Okay. I'd go out there, and the first thing is, you know, that's how I learned the bad words in Spanish first.
Right.
Hijo de puta.
Yeah.
That's it. You know. And I don't know if anybody speaks Spanish. I'm sure people that listen to this speak Spanish, but I didn't know what it meant. But
right,
it's just the way it sounded. Hijo de puta. It just sounded bad.
Right.
You know? I said, oh, that can't be good. Cabron. You know?
Yeah.
And it was just, that's how I learned the bad words. But I could not take three or four steps on the street
right,
in Puerto Rico without somebody saying something to me. And they wouldn't come up and confront me directly.
Right.
Because they were kind of afraid of me, but they would throw rocks at me.
But that's the question I had. I heard so many stories from Puerto Rico, and I, out of all the places I've been throughout my career, Puerto Rico was not one of the places I've been. So I heard stories back in the day, and since you had that kind of heat, people throwing spark plugs, quarters,
everything,
cups
glass,
of piss, this, that, whatever, straight up shoot?
Yes. I made really, really good money there.
Right.
But I earned every dime of it. Because when I went down there, they said, well, we put the main event on fourth. And I went, well, that is stupid as hell. Why would you put your main event on fourth? Oh, these stupid people. What the heck? Till I went out there.
And you found out.
And fourth match, they almost beat me to death. And I asked somebody in the office, I said, really, is that the reason? They said, yes, because if you wait later in the night,
yeah,
they really get drunk and they'll kill you.
Right.
And I said, oh, well, now they're the smartest people in the world. Yeah. Put me on fourth. I would remember we had so much heat. It was me and Frank Elaine. We were the Vaqueros Locos, the crazy cowboys,
yep.
I guess. We'd have to, the show would start at 8:30, or they would advertise 8:30. It would start like 20 after 9, or whenever they got ready, you know. And the people would be lined up at 4:30 in the afternoon to buy tickets. And that's when we would get there.
Jesus.
And we get in there, and now we got all that time to kill. And then after the matches, right, say one of the guys would be on the main event, we'd be traveling with them, we'd have to wait to the matches were over. And sometimes in some of the big stadium shows, matches would be over at 11, 11:30. We'd leave at 2:30 in the morning. Because people would wait on you.
Right.
And they'd say, oh, they'll be out in a minute, and they'd all have rocks. And
yeah.
I remember a guy down there, he was wrestling, and he told me one time, and he says, Dutch, he said, I remember when I was a kid. He said, I would bring rocks to the matches, and I would sell them for a nickel apiece. I said, well, you no good bastard, you know?
Yeah.
And when you would hit that field, sometimes they would throw so much stuff.
Right.
It resembled a biblical stoning.
Right.
That's when I developed the hat and the poncho. Because what the poncho did, I just pull it down.
Right.
And it would hit that and hit my hat. I'd turn the hat toward the people and we would have the titles, the tag team titles, and I'd put it up around my head. They would just.
Straight up. That's why you come up with a cowboy and
I had the hat anyway.
Yeah.
I actually bought a bigger hat with a bigger brim because it would cover more area. Yeah. And that's when I got the poncho. And I'd pull the poncho down.
Right.
And that would take. And you could hear
the. Could hit you. It would be
rocks, it would be spark plugs. Right. A lot of times it would be a Coke cup with ice in it.
Right.
And they all played baseball year-round, so they all had...
Oh, yeah, they all got
a gun. They all had great arms and had guns, and they would just rip you up.
Hey, so...
You know, you've heard people fighting back from the ring?
Yeah.
A couple of times we fought going to the ring. We had this cage match in Roberto Clemente one time.
Yeah.
We went out there fourth. And we fought. We had about 10 cops around us, and they were punching through, and I'm kicking the cops. It was a moving fight.
Yeah.
We got to the ring, and I got in there, and I went, damn. And then I looked at those people, and they looked at me. They're all drunk. I wish I'd been drunk.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, I just came through those people. And in about 15 minutes, I'm probably going to have to be going back through them because I don't think they're going nowhere.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
And I went back. I remember we got back through them that night, and I actually sat down. When we got back in the dressing room, I just sat down and went, damn, I don't want to do that again.
But you know what? And now as we talk about it, I mean, and it's scary while you're doing it, but you kill for that kind of response, you know, to have that kind of heat as a heel. I mean, that's money.
Yeah.
It's scary as hell.
And
I never had that kind of heat on me or was around in that day when that stuff was going down. But, I mean, that's the kind of heat you dream about.
Well, they thought the space program was fake and wrestling was real.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Because I went down and I talked about their women. I talked about their food. I talked about their language.
Yeah.
Similar to today. But, you know, I was the first one to do it.
Right.
And I touched the nerve because I found out. I didn't know anything about Puerto Rico, but I knew that, and I've had, when I got down there, it's a winter, you know, vacation spot. And I talked to some Puerto Ricans from New York, and they told me that they're very sensitive to, because in New York, Puerto Ricans look down on the native Puerto Ricans.
Really?
You know, they look at them like they're like the rednecks who never, who never left the farm.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And they go down there, and there's a lot of heat between the New Yorkans and the Puerto Ricans, or what they tell me, I don't know. And they said they're sensitive about this and this and this and this. So I just took what they told me and applied it. And, of course, when I would do my interviews, I would do it in English. But I told them I spoke Spanish and I'm very fluent, but I thought it was a primitive language and I refused to speak it. And the guy, his name was Rikin Sanchez, and he was about drunk all the time. And sometimes he would do those interviews. He's hammered.
Yeah.
So he would just, and he'd throw his own commentary in there. And he probably helped me more than anything.
Yeah.
People hated me.
Okay, so with all that heat going on in Puerto Rico, did you ever do a turn and work babyface over there?
No. Never did.
Never
well,
did.
Maybe later on, 10 years later.
Right. But not during the peak of how, the heat.
I remember one time, it was at Christmas, and they said, we want you to dress up like Santa Claus. And Carlos Colon, the big star down there, he was going to wrestle Harley Race for the world title.
Oh, with man.
Roberto Clemente. And I thought it was stupid for me to go out there as Santa Claus. And they said, hand out candy, and they were saying things in Spanish, and I was going, Feliz Navidad, but I got an accent, right?
Yeah.
And they're looking at me, like, my eyes are green. You don't look like Puerto Rican Santa Claus. People are looking at me funny anyway.
Right.
But I remember that, you know, I walked up close to the ring, and when the match was over, I was supposed to hit the ring and, you know, cause Carlos the match.
Right.
Which I did, which was a mistake.
Right.
Later on, in retrospect. And I remember looking at Harley, and, you know, Harley's kind of the type you don't phase much.
Right.
And he looked at me, and he says, Ged, we need to get out of here. I was saying,
Harley
what?
Never talked any louder than that. That's a shoot.
I said, well, I'm thinking, boy, it took you a long time. I said that same conclusion about 5 minutes ago before I got in here.
Yeah.
And, brother, here they come.
Hey, you, as a heel, you had a real mean streak. You was a low-down, dirty piece of trash. As a babyface, you had great fire.
Yeah.
And to me, those are two ingredients. Whether you're working babyface, you got to have fire. You got to be able to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to have that spark. As a heel, you got to be a mean bastard. Your career, you've worked both.
Mm-hmm.
Did you prefer working heel or baby?
Well, you got more control as a heel. You have a lot more control than you... Believe me, without the heels, you don't draw any money.
Well, right. But so you got more control. But so what did you enjoyed working heel the most then?
I did.
Right.
I liked it better. Because at the baby face, you're at the mercy of the heel. The heel's no good, you know, you just struggle through and it's not fun. But heel, I had entertained myself. And in entertaining myself, I could entertain them.
And to me, working as a heel, I mean, you really could do anything and everything you wanted.
Yeah.
As a baby face, you know, there's some things, I mean, you just can't have egg on your face. As a heel, you can.
Mm-hmm.
And you can wipe that egg off when it's time to get some heat. Or if anything happens, if you stumble, if you trip, if anything happens as a heel, you can cover your ass.
Yep. I always enjoyed working heel better.
Right.
It was just more fun to me.
I thought it was, too.
It was more entertaining to me.
Yep.
As a babyface, you go out there, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I enjoyed it. But
right. Yeah, I enjoyed my run as a babyface in Stone Cold, but I always preferred working heel because, to me, to go to your point, it was more enjoyable.
So you can take an experienced heel and he can work with an inexperienced babyface.
Right.
But you reverse that?
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Very hard.
Because then, actually, the inexperienced heel... He's not going anywhere anyway, and the experienced babyface, it actually hurts him a little bit.
Right. Yeah, it can tarnish what he's got going on. How long was it before you've been in the ring, paying your dues, learning the craft, the trade, as we will call it, two guys learning the trade. When did you start getting into the booking end of things?
I think actually when I first started, I got moved onto a creative side in a little bit in Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, you know, when the business began to implode... And I got older, I said, well, you know, there's no places to go. And then I think in those times, you only had WCW.
Mm-hmm.
I think you still had ECW.
Mm-hmm.
You had WWF at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of young guys. I was older. I said, and then I actually started booking in Puerto Rico. I just called them up.
Yeah, I know. You had
hey,
a very...
I said, let me come in and book it. And I remember talking to Carlos Colon. And I think with Carlos, you'd have to give him an idea, and he'd think about it 2 days, then he'd call you back.
Right.
You know, and that's the case with a lot of people.
Right.
And you see, I come in and help us. And I started then.
But you had a successful, you were a good booker. So, I mean, with booking, to me, I mean, you're playing chess. You got all your players, you got your chessboard, and you're moving things around and causing things to happen.
Yep.
What was, you just like red hot heels? How did you like to book your territories?
It wasn't the great wrestling.
Right.
It was good stories.
Right.
That I would get on and I would stay on. And staying on the story, I didn't even really think about it then, but that defined my characters.
Right.
And the characters, I would let, and the thing about Puerto Rico, I would get out there and I would listen to the fans.
Mm-hmm.
And they would tell me what to do. Not because I'm a great booker.
Right.
I'm just a good listener.
Right.
And now, if this guy, if they responded to him, I said, well, he's got some fire. First thing I looked at when the two guys wrestled, if I was going to do anything with them, it's chemistry.
Right.
If they had chemistry, you'd feel it. Because the people feel it. I'd feel it. I said, okay.
Right.
If a guy get out there, he had great moves, but the people sit on the thumbs, eh.
Yeah.
Because then you're forcing it. If you force it, let the people tell you.
Right.
I mean, they don't jump up and holler and scream for nothing. It takes energy. Let them tell you. I remember I had Eddie Gilbert down there, great guy. And I brought him in, and it's Saturday afternoon. We're getting ready to go to the matches, and so right outside San Juan, and we were selling out. We do about 2,000 people every Saturday night. And he looked at me, and Eddie was always the one who wanted to be organized and have everything.
Really?
He would really think about it, and he'd write stuff down. I'd look at him and say, what are you doing? I mean, I would never tell him that.
Yeah.
And Eddie looked at me. We was laying around the pool one Saturday afternoon. Because he was drinking. I was drinking. I was almost an alcoholic in Puerto Rico. Well, I was an alcoholic. And he said, what are we going to do tonight? And I went, I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? I said, I hadn't really thought about it. To Eddie, not thinking about it all week long was like, I can't imagine that. He said, when are you going to start thinking about it? And I said, I don't know. I guess about 7 o'clock when I walk in, tell you the truth. Really? And I would walk in the building with not a clue. You know, I just make it up. And I'd go in there and I'd get me 2 pina coladas from the concession stand or 2 beers. And I wouldn't even start thinking then. I'd enjoy the beers about 7:30, because remember I told you they start late anyway. It'll start 9:30. I got 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I'd walk out there, and I would actually walk out and see what crowd was filtering in. If they were filtering in pretty good, it's going to be a good house. It was going to be a good house anyway. And I would just get the vibe. They would just, I'd just feel it. And I said, all right, this is what we're going to do. And my theory was to go in there and kind of give them closure to a match.
Right.
Usually the good guys are over, the baby face is over, right? And then before that match was over, before the night was over, every baby face would be laying face down.
Right.
And he'll just beat the crap out of them.
Yeah.
And the people never left. When the last match ended, people wouldn't get up and leave.
Yeah.
They'd sit there because I had them educated. They said, all right, let's see what they got for us next week. They figured it out.
Yeah.
And I bet the whole time, and I didn't really believe in DQs.
Yeah.
You know? I bet in the whole time in Puerto Rico in 3 years that I booked the IWA, the last company I booked in there, I bet I had maybe 5 DQs. Because I didn't believe it.
Right.
People buy a ticket to see something, so give it to them. We didn't do a special TV taping. Our Saturday night show, live show, was our TV for the next week. So I would actually show the matches from Saturday night back that I had asked the previous Saturday for them to pay for.
Right.
And when I do big shows, you know, we do 14,000, 16,000 people, you know. And I wouldn't bring in like 10 extra guys from the outside. I'd bring in 1 or 2, and that would be... Because if you bring guys in, the next week, guess what? They're leaving, and you're stuck with your same crew. So I did all my stuff with my crew.
Right.
So I didn't have any... To me, it was an entertaining show, and I did a lot of, like, vignettes, outside vignettes
right.
and stuff. Because I'd be sitting around, and say on a Tuesday, drinking, whatever, and I had a little camera. I didn't have an HD camera. I just had a little handheld camera. And I'd call up somebody, hey... Come over here and pick me up. We're going down to Old San Juan. What are we going to do? Oh, we're going to shoot something for the show Saturday. And I would go down, and we'd shoot something kind of silly, kind of goofy, but with a point.
Right.
We'd play it Saturday. I just make it up. I entertain myself.
Right.
So.
Now, who were some of the guys that were running on top with you?
Savio Vega.
Yep.
You remember him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love working with Savio.
Your good buddy.
Yeah.
And Miguel Perez.
Yep.
Him. Hurricane Castillo. Yep. And then I had this guy named El Exotico, which was, he's the one who bought the rocks, remember?
Right.
When he was a kid, beat me up. And then I would, a guy named Abyss, he was there, and Shane, the glamour boy. And now these, to the general public, you know, these names probably won't mean that much, but I didn't take them because they were great wrestlers. I just told great stories with them.
Right.
And I would, like I said, I would get on a story and I'd stay on it. Ray Gonzalez, he was the Ric Flair of Puerto Rico.
Ray Gonzalez. I got to check into that cat then. I got to find some on YouTube. One other thing I was going to ask you before we jump out of Puerto Rico, you were there when Bruiser Brody got killed.
Yes.
What happened?
Brody was, and he was like me, we were just making shots at the time. I would be in, and he'd be in, and we were both there at the same time, and they had this big show, and they would bring you in for like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday shot, and you would leave on Mondays. And I don't know what happened. There was heat between the invader and him, from what I heard. I'd never heard anything previously that they had heat. And I remember I rode to the show that night with Tony Atlas,
yep,
and Brody. We went in, and I've written an article. It's on the internet if you want to look for it somewhere. I don't even know where it is now. But I could always feel, I mean, guys who are survivalists, I think you have the same feeling. You can walk into a room and you can feel tension.
Right.
You can feel it. And I felt tension that night when I walked in there, but I couldn't pinpoint it. But it was a very uncomfortable feeling, a very awkward feeling. And I sat down, and this was about 7 o'clock, 7:30 maybe. The feeling became kind of overbearing. I said, I got to get out of here.
Really?
Yes. So I got up and walked, and I remember walking in, and I had a walk by the invader, Carlos, and Jovica, who owned the company. And they were sitting there, and I don't know what was going on with them. They just didn't, I can't pinpoint anything, but I walked out to the dugout just to see who was coming in, because I didn't want to be in that closed up environment.
Right.
And I bet I was out there 5 minutes maybe, and when I walked back in, it had already happened.
Oh.
Because I heard that the invader got up, and I've written this, and there's nothing that's a secret, and he asked Brody, can I see you in the shower? And they walked into the shower. What happened in the shower?
Oh.
What happened? And they said he staggered out, he was cut, and he went down. You know, it was chaos in there. And
yeah.
The invader left, he took off, he left the building. And Brody laid there for like a long time.
Right.
And he was hemorrhaging. And it took the ambulance a long time to get there, because that's the infrastructure of Puerto Rico.
Right.
They weren't built for the cars. And the place was jam-packed. You couldn't move.
Everybody's trying to get in the building.
Everybody's trying to get in. And they finally, I think, somebody called the radio station and told them to put out a call for the nearest ambulance crew to go to the stadium. And the ambulance crew heard it. They was at a McDonald's or they was at a Hardee's or something.
Right.
And they came over there.
Right.
And it took them a long time to get him out. And I remember, after it happened, I went back to the hotel that night.
But y'all worked the show then?
Worked the show.
Okay.
Yeah. Worked the show.
Damn, the show must go on.
Yeah. And we didn't know what had happened to him. But when I left.
So at that point, you didn't know whether he was going to make it or not, but he was probably alive when they took him out?
Yeah, I didn't think he was going to die.
Right.
I didn't think that.
Right.
You know, but I knew it was pretty serious.
Yeah.
Because I had a doctor tell me that, you know, it was serious because he was bleeding internally.
Yeah.
And they took him to the hospital. And after I left the building that night, it's called Centro Medico, which is like medical center, you know. And I went over there and I went into the emergency room and a guy was walking out. And I said, hey, do you know anything about the wrestler they brought here? And he said, oh, yeah, are you with him? I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm the surgeon who saw him. I said, how's he doing? And he just like, well, it's touch and go. And that was about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I went back to the hotel. And I remember I got up that morning at the hotel, beautiful morning in Puerto Rico, beautiful morning. And I asked the receptionist, could she call the hospital and check on him? And she called and she started crying. And she said, I hate to tell you this, but your friend, he didn't make it. So.
Damn.
It was strange that would happen, because, you know, you think of a dressing room as a sanctuary.
Right.
But it wasn't. And then later on, they had a trial and they had all this.
Yeah.
And you know, everybody knows how it ended.
Yeah, man, weird deal. I just wanted to cover that because I know you spent a lot of time down there. I was, of course, a big Bruiser Brody fan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just loved the way the guy took care of business in the ring and his promos and all that. So from a big fan standpoint, and of course, my old travel partner was Mr. USA Tony Atlas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never really talked about the Brody incident. But he said he would kind of was holding on to Brody there for a while.
Tony Atlas was one who actually, Brody was a big guy.
Yes.
300 pounds, yeah. 290. And the Puerto Rican paramex, they couldn't carry him.
Yeah.
You know, because, the legs fold out.
Yeah.
They had to go up some steps. They couldn't do that. So they had to actually carry him. And I remember Atlas actually carried the back end. Had two guys or three guys on the front. They picked up the front. He picked up the back and they got him to the ambulance.
God dang.
Sad story.
A bad story. And we're going to segue out of a bad story. I want to go back real quickly. I think the building was Evansville. We ran Evansville on a Wednesday every week, USWA, and that's where we got our paychecks. I take us back. It happened in Louisville. It was in Louisville, Kentucky, and it was you and I in a tag match. There might have been one other guy on our side. It might have been a six-man, but our opponents were at the time The Undertaker, working as, what, the Punisher?
Master of Pain.
Was it Master of Pain?
Mop.
Okay, he was a Master of Pain at that time. I think you had given me, one time, before I get into that story, we were riding down the road, you, myself, and Chris Champion, and you had given me the Steve Austin name, and we were talking back and forth and just jacking with each other, and you go, hey, look at it this way. He goes, one of these days, you can turn heel and call yourself Stunning Steve Austin and be a cocky, arrogant heel. Yeah. So I think at the time, I just came back as Stunning Steve Austin. Nonetheless, we're in the Louisville there in the gardens. And we got a tag match, and the Master Pain's over there, along with Soul Taker, who people know as the Godfather from WWE. Maybe, like I said, maybe to some other
people. See, I was running my own developmental and didn't even know it.
Yeah, I didn't even know it. Boy, what a cast of characters there was in that damn ring. But we're standing on the corner. There was a six-man tag. Someone else in the ring, and you and me are standing on each corner, and you look at me, and this is like telling the big bully or the dumb kid on the playground to go do something, and they go do it.
Yeah.
I was so green. You go, hey, next time you get in there, pick up that big-ass Soul Taker and slam him. So I said, okay. So sure enough, I get tagged in. Soul Taker gets tagged in. This is a big dude. He probably weighed about time, maybe 330.
Yeah.
Big dude. And you know, I was all in shape, probably 255. So as soon as I get in the ring, I pick his ass up and slam him. It was like, you know, he wasn't expecting that. You know, he was the senior guy in the ring. I was probably going to be on the listening end at that time. And so he got over like a fart in church. And I remember he had that little come to Jesus meeting with me once we got in the dressing room. And he goes, hey, brother, he goes, next time we get in the ring, you just slam me. The deal was, you know, I just took your advice and went and slammed a guy, and it pissed him off to no end. And I think going to the building that night also, I just tried to hook up with
Who did you slam, Undertaker?
No, I slammed Soul Taker. But what I had done was me and Undertaker were going to ride together that night, or something happened, and they were going to keep him heel or babyface, and I'd come in as a babyface, so we couldn't ride together.
Yeah.
And so I just made the off comment of to Mark, who I didn't even know at the time, but I figured we're two Texas guys. He gets my sense of humor.
Yeah.
I said, okay, we can't ride tonight. I said, well, I'll see you tonight at the building. I'll stretch your ass and I'll stretch your ass in the ring. That's what I said to him. Well, I pissed him off.
Yeah.
I didn't know I'd pissed him off. So there I am. I think Soul Taker tagged out. I tagged back in, and there's Undertaker, Master of Pain, and he puts me in some kind of crazy Japanese stretch hold, and he wasn't torturing me, but I couldn't go nowhere until he decided to relinquish the hold.
Yeah.
And so I was just laying there in the middle of the ring thinking, God dang, what in the flying hell is going on here?
To me, I thought that was in Lebanon because I was watching it.
It could have been Lebanon.
Yeah, and I'm watching from the corner.
Yeah.
And it kept going on, kept going. I said, all right, Mark, let him up. Let him up, Mark. Let him up. Finally, he let you up. He got up like, what the hell?
I didn't know where to grab or wind my watch. I was like, what is going on here? I didn't know I'd piss the guy off.
You know, I was best man at Mark's wedding.
Yeah.
Undertaker's wedding. And that was an experience. So, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah. But riding down the road, did you ever get into the ribbon stuff?
No, not really.
I wasn't a real big ribbon.
I didn't really get into that.
Yeah.
I got in like the ribbing, but like instant ribbing and then back to verbal stuff.
Yeah.
Like wrestler's court.
Wrestler's court.
You remember wrestler's court, right?
Yeah, of course.
Did I do it to you?
Nope, I never was in wrestler's court.
I never put you in wrestler's court.
No, you never put me in wrestler's court.
I put Mark in it.
Yeah.
Undertaker.
What happened?
About every day.
Every day?
I'd do something.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you know, he would go on to take the role of being the judge later on in the locker room with WWE.
He took it.
Yeah, he took it.
And him and Bradshaw.
Yeah, correct.
I used to put Bradshaw in wrestler's court, too.
Yeah.
So the wrestler's court, actually, I started back in, because I used to watch
Judge Judy
all the time.
Yeah.
And I loved it, so I put wrestler's court.
Tell my people what exactly wrestler's court is.
Wrestler's court is a kangaroo court where you take and you just convict a guy real quickly, you know, for some bull crap,
yeah,
you know, made up, trumped up charge. Undertaker, it was like, or a lot of guys, was it was like romancing the girls.
Yeah.
You know, that was like, you couldn't do that, you know.
And right.
It was like being a prima donna, you know.
Right.
We do that. You can't do this. Then I would call witnesses, and I'd say, tell the truth, yeah. And I said, do you know the defendant? Yes, I do. And did this so-and-so happen, this, that, and the other? And he would try to, and I would be the judge and the prosecutor, you know. So somebody would, he would object, and I'd overrule him, and then I would give him time to, you know, state his case, and I've heard enough. I do like the Judge Judy. I've heard enough, you know. And then I did tap the dashboard of the car, or wherever it was, and I'd render a decision.
Yeah.
Always against the defendant.
Oh, of course.
I was like undefeated.
Yeah.
I won every case.
But it turned into an institution because, I mean, you know, if you lost a wrestler scored, I mean, you really lost.
Yeah, you did.
You did.
And it was fun, and it was, you know, unless you have fun going up and down the road, it can be a miserable experience. Like, if you ride with someone or you travel with someone and you don't really enjoy being with them, you got to enjoy yourself. That's why the trips we made were actually short.
Oh, yeah. We talk all the time.
And it just fly by. So
I remember something changed or whatever happened. Because we rode together for a long time. And maybe it was that time I came back after the program that Jerry Jarrett sent me back to Dallas to work with Chris. And I thought I was being fired. He goes, hell no, we're not firing you. We're turning you heel over in Texas to work with Chris. Came back. I'm over to Congress Inn. Congress Inn ain't the greatest place in the world to stay. But when you ain't got no money, and they let me pay my bill whenever I got the money, that's where I stayed. Dr. Tom Pritchard was staying about 10 doors down.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't on the same page. Now, obviously, Tom was a distinguished veteran at the time. He had a damn good hand in the ring, damn good promo, work his ass off. And by, you know, he was Tony Anthony, dirty white boy, had just gone to Japan. So Dr. Tom was driving his car. I had my Hyundai. Well, white boy's car broke down. We got to start riding together. Boy, I tell you what, that oil and water for the first few trips. And then all of a sudden, we clicked. We got on the same page. And anybody can't get along with Tom Pritchard, there's something wrong with him. And another guy.
Tom has got to warm up to you. You don't have to warm up to him. He's got to warm up to you.
Oh, yeah. So now, Uncle Zeb. Mm-hmm. Currently, WWE. Tell me about Uncle Zeb.
Uncle Zeb, well, it's not Uncle Zeb, it's Zeb.
Okay, Zeb.
I've graduated, so he really is like a crazy uncle. You don't know what he's going to say. It's like you're saying, we're going to have a birthday party, and is Uncle Zeb coming? Yeah. Oh, God, why did you? Oh, you know he's going to say something. It's going to piss everybody off. There's going to be a big fight. He's going to have a couple of drinks. He's going to say a bunch of. So that's basically the character. You ever see, what's the name of this movie that Clint Eastwood did in? Gran Torino.
Gran Torino.
That's what he's really...
Got you. You speak what's on your mind.
Yeah. Because that was one of the greatest movies I ever saw, one of the greatest finishes I ever saw.
Right.
You know, because it made sense.
Right.
And he's a disillusioned guy, disillusioned with the country. But if you get to talking to him, he can convince you that this is really what's happening. So when you look out on the street, you see what he's talking about.
Right.
He sees it. He sees it a different way than other people would see it, but you really can't discount what he's seeing.
Right.
Because there is an element of truth.
It's an honest account of what he sees.
Right. And but you can disagree with him.
Right.
Doesn't mean he's wrong.
No.
So, and that's what he is.
So, the real Americans.
Yeah.
We've got Jack Swagger. We've got Antonio Cesaro.
Right.
Are you able to spend any time with these cats on the road at all?
Oh, all the time.
How's that going? Y'all making road trips together? What's the travel system these days?
Well, we ride together a lot.
Yeah. You know? Talking about the business?
They talk about everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't change. Yep. I still talk about what I want to talk about. And when I meet somebody, I like to find out about them, their experiences, their country, you know, their past. Say with Jack, I talk about Oklahoma football and what he did and this, that, and then I know about his family and, you know, and I kind of like to know that where he comes from.
Right.
Antonio's the same thing. Antonio has a unique story. A lot of people say, how can you take him as a real American when he's not even from America? Well, he actually came through the right way.
Yeah.
He got his green card. He got all this. He paid all the dues. He did everything he's supposed to do legally. So, and he's working for, I guess he's working for citizenship now. But he came through the right way. He came through the legal channels. He didn't just come, like I say, sneaking across the border. He came in, and he didn't break any laws. He followed what we had set forward, and so that's how he's a real American. But people, you know, they say, well, he can't be a real American. Yes, he can, because he's becoming one right now. So,
a couple of weeks back on Monday Night Raw, guys in the ring, and Jesus Christ, I can't remember if it was, maybe it was with the Usos. But anyway, Swagger was having a little bit of a tough time in there. He rolls out, you trying to get his thoughts together and slap the piss out of him.
Yep.
He goes in there, starts getting a little bit more aggressive, turns the tide in his favor, tags in Antonio.
Well, I had to wake him up.
Right.
Because Jack, sometimes he has a, you got to make him mean.
Right.
He has all the tools. He has the size.
Mm-hmm.
He has the ability.
Amateur pedigree.
Yes, he does.
So he's got some skill.
Yes, he does. And I just wanted to wake him up.
Focus him. And
it made him mad.
Made him mad.
We had words in the back. He said, why'd you do that?
Yeah.
I said, well, I wanted to, I guess. I don't know. What are you going to do, beat me up?
But, sometimes, so hopefully he will learn from this. And next time he steps into the squared circle, it's with an attitude that, winner or loser.
Well, seriously, when you go to the ring, when you go and do anything, you got to have an attitude. You got to have an ego. And you got to think you're the best in the world. Otherwise, you don't even belong in that ring.
Hallelujah. Let's give it up for GEICO for supporting Steve Austin Show for all these years. In just 15 minutes, you can save 15% or more on car insurance. GEICO has been offering great rates and great service for over 75 years. And anytime you need help, you can speak to one of their trained specialists 24/7. Go to GEICO.com and start saving cash. Extra money in your pocket, it may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. Don't forget to rate and review Steve Austin Show on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends to check us out. If you want to reach me here on the podcast, send an email to questions@steveaustinshow.com as far as questions, suggestions, or people you'd like me to talk to. And my beer, Steve Austin's Broken Skull IPA from El Segundo Brewing Company, reached the East Coast. We're out there in Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey. Get on the El Segundo Brewing Company website, click on the BS IPA button, and an interactive map will pop out and will tell you a location near you to purchase the best IPA in America. I'm proud to be out there on the East Coast representing with this badass IPA. Hey, man, don't forget, over there on ProWrestlingTees.com/Steve Austin, I have my King of Attitude shirts that are available at Pro Wrestling Tees, and Broken Skull Ranch apparel still available. New shirts, especially the King of Attitude shirts, fixing to be added. If you're looking for a badass knife, cold steel Broken Skull knife, working man knife, you can find them at Amazon, amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially WWE 2K20, Zorro.com, GEICO, and betonline.ag. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. If you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, @SteveAustinBSR. Until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.